Good morning, everybody. How lovely to see you all. And if you don't know me, my name is Paul, and I'm Janet's clergy colleague, the vicar of this church, and it's my pleasure again to extend my own words of welcome to you, to our midweek carols, which is growing year by year, and that is wonderful to see. I was reflecting the other day, obviously as a vicar, you get slightly involved in Christmas. And I remember before I got ordained wondering whether being a vicar would actually dull my enjoyment of Christmas. And I'm delighted to say 30-some years in, I love Christmas as much as I ever did. I think it's absolutely brilliant. I enjoy everything, including the children. So I know there's a couple of parents and grandparents who were here on Monday when our preschool did their full nativity, wearing many of the costumes that you've just seen. And one little lad came on, he was as a camel, and I noticed that he had his tail in his hand. And I remember thinking, gosh, that's a long tail for a camel. And I realized the tail was in his hand, but not attached to his costume where it should be. And the nativity wasn't that long, but it was long enough for this little lad to be conscious that he had a tail that probably, you know, and so on. And he obviously wasn't quite sure what to do. And eventually, if you saw the camels, they've got those big, and he just lifted his thing and popped his tail in and just put it on top of his head and put his hat down. And I thought he could be a smuggler in a future life, but it was lovely to see that. And we were oohing and aahing over Janet's broken finger at the beginning and giving her our sympathy. Medics tell me that when they're treating an illness or an injury, what they're looking for is that breakthrough moment when the patient realizes, sorry, I shouldn't say breakthrough moment, should I? That wasn't intentional. But that moment when the patient realizes it's going to be okay and things will get better. I think for me, this happened for Janet yesterday. We had our staff team social and we do a secret Santa. And Janet's husband, Rob, who's sitting beside her at the front, opened his, and it was a pair of marigold washing-up gloves. And I could see, bright pink, and I could see in Janet's face the thought, actually, there might be an upside to having broken my little finger at Christmas time. I'd like to say a couple of personal thank yous, because we may not have time for that at the end, who knows, but it takes quite a lot to put on a service like this, and I'm grateful to those who've prepared the church and those who are our musicians and our singers, those who are working on the tech at the back, Chris and Mark, those who've prepared our food, and of course Lizette, who's not here today because she's not well, and Rian, who's not with us today because she's attending a family, a funeral back in her previous church. So can we just pause and give a round of applause to all of those, and to Janet and to Caroline, who've led, and our readers, to thank them for that. Well, Christmas will, of course, soon be over. It always goes quickly. And we all need something to look forward to in January. I wonder if we've got any Bake Off fans here. Oh, two. Good. Are there really only two Bake Off fans in the entire? No, we've got a few more. On January the 18th, we are privileged as a church to be hosting Tearfund's national tour called Cakes, Bakes and Faith. And it features Martha Collinson, who was the youngest ever finalist in Bake Off, and Will Torrent, who's an award-winning pâtissier. Where the choir is now, there's going to be a kitchen. There'll be a live Bake Off. You can enter your own cake for a cake competition. You can ask questions about what goes on behind the scenes at Bake Off. That's on January the 18th, and they'll be talking about their careers and what faith means to them. So do book for that. It's going to be a great thing to look forward to in the new year. So who's all set for Christmas? Oh, gosh, yes. Come on, don't be worried. I know it's the sort of thing you can't really imagine to, yes. Some of us are all ready for Christmas. I wonder what's still on the list of the rest of you. Are all the presents bought? And if they're bought, are they wrapped? Is the food in? And if it is, does it need preparation? Has the cake been sorted? Have the beds been made for the guests who are coming to stay? Or has the journey been planned if we're going elsewhere? There's just so much to do at Christmas. But for those of you with your hands up, is it a good feeling that Christmas, look at you, see? Not exactly smug, but at least content compared with the rest of us. It's great to know that things are sorted. I thought we'd have a little quiz this morning, and I was going to put the clues on the screens. I do hope all of you have had the words in the sheets, and not some of you haven't been relying on the screens. It's my fault. I thought it would be lovely to keep our background up for the preschool to sing in front of, and we need it for the Christchurch primary tomorrow. I also thought it might make our choir look a bit better if they're sitting in front of it. Well, anyway, yes, it's the thought that counts, isn't it? But there we are. So I'm going to have to read these quizzes. So basically, these are opening lines of famous novels. And if you know the answer, please put your hand up. Here we go. It is a truth universally acknowledged that a single... Okay, somebody going to shout that one out? Pride and Prejudice by... Okay, I thought we'd start with an easy one. Call me Ishmael. Only Paul knows it. No, we got, and Randall knows. Moby Dick, fantastic, by Herman Melville. This is one of my own favorites. There was a boy called Eustace Clarence Scrub, and he almost deserved it. Catherine? Voyage of the Dawn Treader by C.S. Lewis. It was the best of times, it was the worst of times. Oh, we've got literary people around. Clough, you've not had a go. Tale of Two Cities by Charles Dickens. Last night I dreamt I went to Manderley again. Rebecca by Daphne du Maurier. Happy families are all alike. Every unhappy family is unhappy in its own way. Anybody? Anna Karenina by Leo Tolstoy. Just a couple more. All children except one grow up. Peter Pan by J.M. Barrie. Final one. Whether I shall turn out to be the hero of my own life, or whether that station will be held by anybody else, these pages must show. Jackie again. David Copperfield. Quick round of applause for all those who are so on the ball with that. So here's a question. Why are those opening lines so well known? Well, because of the words that follow. In fact, if the words that follow did not follow, in other words, if the novels had never been completed, those opening lines would be meaningless. I could have read them out if I would have found them, which would have been virtually impossible, and nobody would know why I was reading them. The opening lines are only remembered and famous and celebrated because of the story that follows. With the story of Jesus that's actually told four times, most of us, I know, but maybe not everybody will know that, four different accounts of his birth, his life, his death, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. The openings, and certainly the openings of Matthew and Luke, are famous and celebrated by many people just once a year because they retell the Christmas story. And unlike those famous opening lines of novels, those opening chapters of Matthew and Luke can, for many, become detached from the story that follows. Matthew and Luke flesh out the story of Christmas. And the stories are full of angels, which is our theme as a church for this year's Christmas. Luke has an angel going to Zechariah, an angel who gets a name, Gabriel, going to Mary. And the angels come with news of unexpected pregnancies. Well, that's putting it mildly, not just unexpected, impossible pregnancies. Zechariah and Elizabeth, because they're too old. Mary, because she has no husband. Matthew has an angel going to Joseph. And Matthew and Luke then recount the actual birth of Jesus. And we've heard these readings today. And for all of us, I imagine, there will be a measure of emotion in heart and mind as we hear those words read. The emotions may be to do with memory and family and childhood and memories of joy. But my question for you all is, in your heart and mind, are those stories detached from what follows? Or are the Christmas stories anchored for you in the story that follows? If those stories had not followed or had not been recorded, no one would have heard the stories of Luke and Matthew. Our years would end, well, I know they do end, in a grey drizzle. Or if we're in Narnia, always winter but never Christmas. And there are three essential elements to every human life. There's birth, there's death, and there's everything that happens in between. And I just want to talk very briefly this morning about those three elements in the life of the baby whose birth we celebrate here today. Birth, firstly. Today, 360,000 babies are born every day. 360,000 babies are born, human babies, in this world every day. That's about 250 a minute. It's why midwives always look so tired. So why is this one so special? So that's 360,000 a year, I think. Is it a year? Somebody? No, I think it's a day. Anyway, let's stay with it. It's a lot. It's a lot of work for midwives. And of course, Christmas is important chiefly because it begins a story. It celebrates a birth. That's what the angels are for. The angels are there to flag to those of us who read the stories that this baby is special. As far as I'm aware, on the 18th of June, 1960, which was a great year to be born, my parents recorded no angel visitations whatsoever, either then or in the months preceding. This birth was special. Secondly, the life, what happened between birth and death for Jesus? Global life expectancy today is 71, 70 for men and 72 for women. In Jesus' day, of course, the global life expectancy would have been lower, but only because of the greater instance of child and infant mortality. Once past those years, you stood as good a chance as any of living to a good old age. And the Christmas stories include four such people: Zechariah, Elizabeth, Simeon, and Anna. Anna's the only one we're told had lived by then to 84. So when Jesus died in his mid-30s, he died young, even in his day. But what a life. History, of course, is littered with significant lives. Novelists, such as those we remembered earlier, explorers, artists, scientists, medical pioneers, humanitarians. But none like Jesus. And if you think that's just a vicar speaking, well, it was just a vicar speaking, unless there was an echo. But actually, the people who study human history largely agree with that. And you can test this out simply by reading the commentaries of people. I'm not talking about believers. I'm just talking about people who look at human history. And I want to read you some words from one of them. And I've chosen this simply because he died recently and therefore he's been in the news. Clive James. You may have enjoyed his poetry. You may have enjoyed his TV presenting. He was a great character, very humorous and quite varied in his skills. And Clive James was throughout his life very open about the fact that he did not have faith. Didn't have any faith. And yet he wrote about Jesus on a regular basis. And he referred to Jesus as the leading man. And he went on to explain that he meant the whole of history's leading man. So will you just allow me to read a few of his words to you over the next couple of minutes? They're seasonal words. He wrote this at this time of year a number of years ago. In these weeks, in all the days of Advent until Christmas Day, and from then on until Twelfth Night, the season wherein his birth is celebrated, I have been giving him and will yet give him much thought. For me, he didn't need to be crucified in order to prove his capacity for sacrifice. He proved that when he faced the crowd who wanted to stone to death the woman caught in adultery. It was a turning point in history, because nothing quite like that had ever been recorded before. Since the same crowd of fanatics might very well have stoned him for interrupting their dreadful ceremony, clearly he was brave beyond the imagination of most of us. But it was the generosity of the intervention that set a new mark. He met the same mark again when he promised a place near him in heaven to the woman who had washed his feet. Imagine the whispering abuse he earned for that. Imagine the shouted abuse. I first heard about these things in Sunday school when I was very young. And I can't think of how the same permanently necessary message about tolerance could have been transmitted in any other way. No matter how intolerant the churches got in all their years of power, not even when they were burning people at the stake, they never managed to wipe out the impression of his understanding spirit. Those moments in the gospel would alone be enough to prove the importance of keeping alive all we can about his story. He goes on to say that the personality of Jesus gives us a measure for how we should lead our lives on earth. Much of the beauty of the English language has the Bible as its fountain, and an education without a Bible is no education. We should cherish the Christian remnants that do not conflict with the merciful and all-comprehending nature of the man whose life on earth was the beginning of it all. Then he turns finally to a personal thought. The Christmas will come when our granddaughter will want to know more about just whose birthday Christmas is, and an important part of her upbringing will begin. Her parents are both believers in the classic sense, but it might be that their daughter will one day, as I did, become an unbeliever. She might not believe that Jesus is still alive in heaven, but there is one important thing that even I will be able to tell her, which is that Jesus, the first great man to be a champion of women, believed in her, and that alone would be sufficient cause to bless every night and day of the season wherein his birth is celebrated. If we are wise, the human race will never allow the memory of that man to die. I read those words because they are the words of a non-Christian, recognizing that this life did something in our world, brought something to our world, left a mark on our world that is above those left and brought by others. You might not agree, but if you start to research what secular students of human history say, I think you will be surprised at the commonality of view about Jesus. But of course, for Christians, for those of us who do have faith, it is the third movement, the third element that is key. It is the death of Jesus. A bit like football, if I'm not too irreverent. Christmas is important, but Easter is vital. There are 151,600 deaths every day. That's 105 a minute. So again, the question, what is so special about this death? We talk, not that regularly, but we talk about people giving their life for a great cause, giving their life for something more important than life itself, being willing to sacrifice either literally on the field of battle, for example, or actually just in that slow, mundane, everyday stepping out a life of service of others. We talk about that. And we might say that Jesus did that. But according to the Bible, there are two things above all that make this death special, that bring back significance to the birth and seal the significance of his life. And those two things are these, and many of you will already be aware of them, I know. Firstly, it made salvation possible. It made a way for human beings to comprehend a life that might be different, where we might not be stuck under the clouds of guilt and shame that everyone feels at some stage, that we might not be stuck with the same repeated patterns by which our words and our deeds and even our thoughts wound others and make this world a slightly less tolerant place for others. What the Bible calls sin. Not the most popular word in our dictionaries today, but a word which in the Greek means to miss the mark at archery. It was literally the word that was used if you were practicing your archery skills and you missed. And I find that helpful because I've yet to meet a human being who doesn't have a target in life. I've yet to meet a human being, however near or far they may be from my faith, who doesn't aim to be a better person, to make a greater contribution to the world in which they live. And I've rarely met anyone who won't at some point acknowledge that they miss even the targets they set themselves, as do I. And in Jesus and in his death, the church believes and proclaims that that death makes it possible to be forgiven for everything that has ever been what it should not have been. And secondly, his death is significant in our belief because it is not the end of the story. We're told in the Gospels that Jesus rose again, that death, which is every human life's final enemy, yours and mine equally, death is probably the most inclusive, equal opportunity reality there is in the world. It treats all of us the same. It beckons all of us. And yet we believe there is one man, this God, Jesus, for whom it was not the end, for whom death could not write the full stop, for whom death could not write the closing words of the story. For Jesus, and we believe for those who put their faith in him, the story does not end, but goes on to chapter after yet more glorious chapter. My opening question was whether you're all set for Christmas and reflecting on how wonderful it is to be able to say yes. My personal testimony, although I probably fear dying as much as the next person, I can honestly say that I feel ready for death itself because of Jesus, because of the life that began in our Christmas stories, because of the life that he lived, and supremely because of the death he died and the death he conquered. And I believe that whatever happens to me over the course of my life and however it ends, actually, at that moment, he will be there to greet me and usher me in to the greater story, whose chapters get better and better. C.S. Lewis closes his Narnia Chronicles with that image that we might imagine, and this is the way we see life from this side of the grave. We might imagine that that is where the story ends. But C.S. Lewis says quite the opposite. It was simply the title page and the opening words of the first chapter of the great story that continues to be told and gets richer and more glorious. So my final question is whether you're ready for that. Hark, the herald angels sing. Glory to the newborn King. Peace on earth and mercy mild, God and sinners reconciled. Joyful all ye nations rise, join the triumph of the skies. With the angelic host proclaim, Christ is born in Bethlehem. Christ by highest heaven adored, Christ the everlasting Lord. Late in time behold him come, offspring of the Virgin's womb. Veiled in flesh the Godhead see, hail the incarnate deity. Pleased as man with man to dwell, Jesus our Emmanuel. Hail the heaven-born Prince of Peace. Hail the Son of Righteousness. Light and life to all he brings, risen with healing in his wings. Mild he lays his glory by, born that we no more may die, born to raise the sons of earth, born to give them second birth. If you don't yet have an answer to my second question, I'd be happy to talk to you a little bit over lunch. But now, let's stand and with the angelic host, join in the words, Hark, the herald angels sing, glory to the newborn King.